Well, why don't we start?
Yes, sir.
Unless you want to hear more about my adventures getting here today. Probably don't.
Well, then you know, I'm down. I've lost a lot of weight from being macrobiotic, and all my clothes are being, rehabilitated.
I noticed you lost a lot of weight. In fact, when I saw you in the chair in the lobby, in fact, you had your arms down. It looked like you had lost your arms as well.
No, I still have my arms. But all my clothes are in Boston. They're supposed to get here on Tuesday, so I could have something to wear on the. But they didn't come, of course. So I'm really desperate to have nothing spilled on me by me or by anybody else. And this woman with a lot of jewelry sits down next to me on the seat, gets out a lot of jewelry, and a really expensive looking person. She gets out this enormous Dunkin' Donuts thing of coffee, and puts it on the seat, taking the lid off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the passengers are walking, the plane is jiggling and the coffee is dancing, and I'm thinking, now, how do I phrase this? You know, get that coffee away from me. I can't afford a spill. Finally, I said, look, it's making me nervous. And I added to her, listen, life is desperate. I mean, whatever made you think it was going to be easy getting here from West 92nd? You've lived in New York long enough.
That's right. I've lived here for 25 years. It's never easy getting to work.
Never.
It's never easy. It's not even easy staying at home.
It's gotten so bad. I mean, the subways, they're not so unreliable. They're unreliable enough that if I have to get to the New Yorker, I usually take a taxi and, economize somewhere else. But I've noticed that there are now these 24-hour construction projects. I mean, neither the driver nor you can ever know where the bottlenecks are.
That's right.
You notice that?
Mm-hmm.
And the subway, the same thing. You never know when something's going to break down.
That's right. It's much better these days than it has been in the past. I used to have to allow myself a lot of time. Usually I can do it in about 20 minutes.
Well, listen, the great pleasure of getting older is you don't have to be fair.
That's right.
Everything's worse than it was in the past. You know that.
Well, let's talk about you and the Runaway Soul. You have, you're actually going on a publicity tour. This is your actual first publicity tour, isn't it?
Oh, no.
No?
No. I'm bad words? I'm a hardened old prostitute now. I did one for, Stories in an Almost Classical Mode.
Mm-hmm.
And then, not exactly a tour, but I went to a couple of cities when the hardcover came out. Then I had a week in London when the hardcover came out there. I mean, in England, publicity tour is really easy because you just go around London. From one pick, everything's concentrated there. And then I did one in Germany when the first volume of Stories came out, and the Germans got kind of excited about it. And was selling a lot of copies, so the publisher brought me over and I did 8 cities. And the Germans, like to hear people read in a language they don't understand. So I'd be reading in a bookstore and it'd be 800 people. Can you imagine? And Spain and France. So I'm sort of used to it, except you can never get used to traveling anymore because it's so weird. They've got airplanes with no air on them. An airplane food that's really strange. Going out to Minneapolis, they served a casserole that was entirely unidentifiable. And I kept asking, what is this? Nobody knew.
It was probably chicken.
Well, I don't think there was anything. No, it was, it looked.
I mean, that's a good guess. I mean, I'm just guessing
the
myself.
Basic,
the
basic
probabilities were.
It was some kind of fancy macaroni that was bent into shape. And it was sort of gray-green. I mean, it was really kind of weird.
Well, I had the feeling when The Runaway Soul came out in hardcover that you weren't doing a lot of publicity.
I had never done any. You were, I think, the very first book program of any kind I'd ever been on. And you were very gentle. I could see from your face it's not going to be like that today. But
I'm always gentle. But there was so much advance anticipation. Now, that's a redundancy. There was so much anticipation for The Runaway Soul that when the book came out, I had, for example, I never received a copy of it. And I didn't, for some reason, I was busy and I didn't request it, but I was kind of monitoring things and watching the reviews and so forth, and nobody offered from Knopf to make you available at that time. So I just got the impression you were going to take a low profile when the book came out.
It's awfully hard to explain. Actually, I'd left Knopf, and I was at Farrar Straus for The Runaway Soul.
Oh, yes.
And for some reason, the way they schedule it, there wasn't a lot of time. Also, they didn't have a lot of galleys. There were 300 and some requests for galleys, and they printed 75. So I went underground because there's no way I can deal with that. And in terms of publicity, so many people were going to review the book, and the atmosphere was sort of, you know, a little bit tense, a little bit unpleasant maybe. But I don't know that I was in any fit condition, actually, to do something then. But there simply wasn't any pre-publication campaign or project. And I don't think the books got... I think the majority of the galley censors were sent to mainstream, you know, big circulation places like Entertainment Weekly, and not to the people who might actually have read it. But those things happen. The next time I publish, which will be in the spring, and I know a little more now, and I can say I want this and I want that. But so far, it's been a little bit, like a monk coming out of a monastery or a belated virginity or something, and I haven't really had much of a grasp of how it should be done or what I should be doing or anything of that sort. You know? The thing about anticipation is that there was a certain amount of anticipation in a small community of readers, and then there was a kind of haze beyond that of people who knew about the other anticipation, so they wondered, you know, what that was for. But then there were a lot of people who you might call it negative anticipation. You know, please don't drop this book on our heads. I mean, it's too long, and one thing and another. One of the things it's been a problem from the beginning from the short stories is most of the people I talk to don't have time to read the book in any comfortable way, you know, before we talk. And when I say, well, I don't write to be read at a sitting, you know, you're allowed just to leaf through the book, and if you're reading on your own, you read some and then you get enough and you close it for a while and then you go back to it. But it's made things interesting, you know, complicated. So often the interviews are about my reputation or what so-and-so said, and we don't talk about the book much, which has given me the feeling, I was telling a friend of mine a few minutes ago, that I'm just beginning, after 20 years of working on it, I'm just beginning to feel that I wrote it. I mean, it's just beginning to come real for me, too. But in most cases, it's a book, and there's a certain, aura about it, the anticipation and some of the praise and some of the attacks. But it's not a real thing yet. It'll be a while.
Well, the last time we chatted, you said, and I can almost quote you directly, you used the term scared, being somewhat frightened as to the kind of reception that the book was going to have, because there was a lot of anticipation for it, and you'd worked so long on it. What happened when the book came out? How did you react?
You want an honest answer?
Of course.
Well, I could pretty well predict. By then, I mean, after the short stories, I sort of knew who stood where and what was likely to happen. But there's a double thing in the head. There's a part of you that really doesn't care. I mean, the text is there, the book is there. And by the time the reviews come out, a certain number of people have read the book and have responded, and the book has its chance at life in this smaller world, you know, or not. And if it has a chance, the reviews really don't matter. But there's another thing, which is that your public life, you know, where you deal with other people, really is affected by this stuff. And also, if you haven't bought a lot of books in your lifetime, and if you're fairly old, as I am, you don't really know if you can stand it. I mean, you really don't know who's going to kill you or not. So the tension, I think, is twice as unbearable, partly because in some senses it doesn't matter. It's almost a luxury. You don't know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. It doesn't matter in this respect. You're actually writing for yourself. This is your art. This is your creation, and what other people think about it doesn't really matter. It's nice to have praise, and it's nice to have people like it. But if they don't like it, and if you don't get the praise, it still stands as a work of art because it's yours.
Well, a little bit like that, but what I was thinking more on the order of was that there are a limited number of readers in this country, and of that group, there's a still more limited number of good readers. That is, people who don't just skim, you know, who read. And in that group, there's a limited amount of time they have to read. And if you have access to even just a small part of the serious readers, this group of serious readers, if you have access to some of their attention, you're not well set financially, and not even necessarily psychologically, but you do have readers, and you do get enough response that you're not writing in a vacuum. I don't exactly write for myself. The thing about language is it really has to be directed at a listener. There's no point in forming a sentence. There has to be another end. I mean this end, and there's somebody at the other end who's going to read it or listen to what I say. But I've never been entirely without an audience from the time I started to write. And the what I call the private responses. You know, a critic in Switzerland, two people working on the book, a former editor, you know, who's still a friend. If they respond in a certain way, then the book is beginning to have an existence, you know, without reference to the reviews. But the reviews are tremendously important because, let's say, that the reviews are perceived. I mean, there was. I don't read them because some of them are kind of upsetting. Actually, the praise is upsetting too because, what am I going to do with it? I mean, I'm not going to go around thinking I'm John Milton, so. But the attacks, you work on them by deduction. They wouldn't attack so much. I mean, let's say the book was a kind of bland fake of a certain kind. And I think most of the reviews would have been kind and condescending and only gently dismissive. The more anger that's shown in the attacks, then the more power they think the book or the reputation has. I mean, then they're fighting something, you see. And if the viciousness gets to the point where it's really kind of extraordinary, you know, the one time only, the worst example of it I've ever seen or whatever, well, then maybe the book is one of a kind only, and maybe it's generating some kind of power that really frightens them.
Well, the book does make demands on the reader because it's a long book, but you can compartmentalize it because many of these were stories. I think I can't remember, and some of them may have been in The Abundant Dreamer, which is the English version of stories in an almost classical mode. Half of the stories, I think, yeah. Approximately of that book. Now, I can't remember now which ones are in the stories and which ones are in the novel, but if you can look at, you can compartmentalize and look at The Runaway Soul as a series of stories, and then stop.
Well, they're. Let me say three things quickly. In England, where they're less intimidated in general by literary controversies, and where my reputation hasn't been hanging over anybody's heads, particularly got on the bestseller list for 3 weeks. And the reviews there were just about as mixed as they were here, but the English, you know, reacted somewhat differently. And the second thing is, none of the stories that have been printed are actually in the book. It's all separate material. But the third thing is, the way I write is, whether it's experimental or new to some extent. And if it works for you, I mean, if you're enjoying it, I mean, if you're having a response to it, a certain number of pages are enough. That is, it's not like reading a story and then stopping, but there's certain points where it's had an effect on you. You want to absorb it, or you want to think about it. It's not something that you start on page one and read through in, you know, 3 days and three nights. And this way in which it's read, it's my daughter, who's a fan, but it took her about 6 months, but she's busy and she's got other things in her life, and she thought it was terrific, and sometimes the suspense got her and she didn't want to stop, but she had to, but sometimes she did want to stop. And then after a while, she went back. When I read it over, when I was doing the galleys, that was the way I worked. I mean, after a certain amount of time, the kind of response. Let me explain the response. There's one guy in Illinois who said it's like the language is meant to be evocative. That is to remind you, the reader, of experiences that you've had, so that if it's working, you're having some kind of autobiographical experience, sort of like a haze between you and the text. And this guy in Illinois wrote and said that it was like being dipped in his own memories, but in another language, so it was almost as if he was dreaming. And he found he read about anywhere from 25 to 150 pages, and then he had to absorb it because it was his own life coming back to him. You see? And, I mean, it wasn't... The book was never designed... I mean, I never imagined that there would be the kind of attention that it got, or that it would ever be treated as a mainstream book. And even as it is, it's... I mean, the favorable responses, it's so hard to explain, but it's to one side of the mainstream, but it's much closer to it than I ever would have expected. This is a very strange society.
I think books also leave an impression, and I will read some. For example, one of the chapters dealing with Nani, who was killed in the fire, and she was not a particularly attractive or friendly person in the book. And I read it, and I didn't think too much about it at the time, but a couple of days later I began thinking about Nani.
Yeah.
And trying to picture her in my mind. And all of a sudden that chapter kind of sank in, but that happened a couple of days later. Before I was just reading it. But yet my mind was like a computer. It was still picking it up and holding it there. And then I would think about it. And this happens to me a lot with books, where I'll read something, I don't think too much of it at the time. Sometimes it has a tremendous impact. Other times, the impact comes later. Is this
that's probably what I mean. But sometimes, if you're reading this, where the sentences are constructed in a... They're not difficult sentences, but they're constructed in a slightly new way. I mean, at the New Yorker, there was always a little problem about how to punctuate them. Even at those moments when the New Yorker decided to be bold and, you know, be this experimental. And if the sentences begin to operate on your memory while you're reading, this thing that you're talking about begins to hit sooner. You can't... there are a lot of ways of writing and publishing books, and what we've sort of come to is a situation where nobody has enough time, and there are a lot of books coming out, and a lot of lives are involved, a lot of lives are at stake. So the books tend to be set up in such a way that they're familiar before you begin them. As a matter of fact, there was a review in the Sunday Times not too long ago, a very favorable review of a novel by another novelist, and he said a good novel must be new but familiar, and it must have familiar themes, and this means that anything which is not directly graspable, which is not immediately formulaic, is going to have a certain kind of problem. It doesn't fit into the mechanisms, you know, as they begin to work. And, you know, the book world is shrinking, isn't it?
In terms of number of publishers, you mean?
Well, when I came to New York, books were really kind of glamorous. And there were, seven newspapers and a lot of radio stations. And they all did something about books. And if a foreign writer came, there were always the photographs of him like a movie star or her, you know, posing at the ship's rail. And books were kind of a dominant cultural thing. And now, you know, they're really not. It seems to me.
Well, I think there is more competition. That's true. I don't know how to answer that, because I'm not sure you're right. But the fact that there don't seem to be a lot of celebrity writers, that's true, as there might have been in the past.
Well, I can't see. I mean, if a book came out analyzing the election by someone like Walter Lippmann, you know, that used to be a really big deal. I can't see it being treated that way or having much influence on this election, for instance. I don't think people pay as much attention to books on the whole. Someone told me that At the University of Wisconsin, the English department met and voted Hemingway off the reading list because he was too difficult.
You ought to try reading Harold Brodkey.
That's not so difficult. It's just a new kind of experience.
Well, the Runaway Soul has one of the most interesting publishing stories that I've ever run across. And I think you ought to address that a little bit for me, because you started it 20 or more years ago. And I got confused with the publisher, because I think it went to a number of publishers over the years, and back to you and back again. And tell me what happened exactly. Give me a little of the history of The Runaway Soul, which was, I believe, called, originally, you were going to call it Party of Animals, I believe.
Well, that was somewhere in mid-career, and that was because of I had to think of a title in order to put on a contract. I started publishing stories in the 50s, and the people who liked them, or thought they were promising, or thought I was promising, wanted me to write a novel. Stories in those days weren't taken very seriously, not as seriously as they are now, and a novel was the thing to do. But they had in mind a certain kind of novel, which I call a conventional novel, or a small, well-made book. And it really wasn't what I had in mind. And I roughed one in. Actually, the first time I tried, the manuscript got destroyed and I didn't have a copy. But the second time I tried, when I went to the publisher and we started talking about it, it was really quite clear that the parameters, the fixed requirements for a publishable novel, well, really weren't anything I was interested in. I'm going to be a little pejorative, stock characterization, familiar actions, the same structure that's been done 50 or 60 times, the same attitudes toward experience, the same attitudes toward characters. So I went to another publisher, and the same sort of struggle began, but different personalities and different philosophies were being enunciated, but it was the same sort of struggle. And they had a very smart guy, and some of them have a lot of respect, at one point said, "You can't do dialogue like this." And I said, "Why not? I mean, it evokes a character, it's a time, it's a place, it's the moment of drama." He said, "It's not book dialogue." So then I went to a third publisher. But actually, the last couple have just been Knopf and Farrar Straus.
Back and forth.
and now HarperCollins. But it's been, and sometimes it's been a little unpleasant, but essentially it's a case of, I'm either wrong and have wasted my time and the publisher's time and money, or it's a new kind of book with a certain merit, and what we have is a reluctant and grudging society and a kind of ungenerous system which certain generous people then insert themselves in. I mean, it's as if my reputation came about because I was great on talk shows, and it wasn't, people didn't laugh at the stories and line up, and it wasn't based on publicity or long literary essays. It was just something that grew from a certain number of people who liked what I did. And it was all off stage. I mean, it was private, unfocused, unrehearsed. And now they say, "All right, we want your novel." So I said, "All right, I'll give you my novel. You'll see, you don't really want it." Well, some of them do, and some of them began to scream, "Oh, we don't want this novel. Why can't it be like this, this, or this? Well, it can't be like that, that, or that, because it's this novel." I mean, it seems to me fairly obvious, but I'm prejudiced.
Well, I hope I didn't misstate myself earlier when you suggested that you don't write for yourself, because I didn't mean to imply that you did, because writing is a matter of communication. You do want someone to receive your words. At the same time, you want to do something that is yours, and yours alone. And it doesn't really matter necessarily what other people think. It's still something that you want to do. Unfortunately, in the publishing world, which has so many conventions, you may not be able to find someone receptive enough to want to publish it. That's the difficult thing. You did finally do that, to your credit. But that's not always easy for people.
It wasn't easy, and the publisher deserves a lot of credit. In fact, one of the favorable reviews, the last paragraph or two paragraphs, was a panegyric about the publisher's courage in printing such a book, especially in this day and age. There were hundreds of considerations that kept me from publishing a book earlier. And it would be I mean, some of it was that I was shy, of course, but it is difficult to walk around saying, look, here's this odd book. I mean, take a look at it. You might like it. And it's also very... It's very strange living suspended between the extreme praise, and you know how extreme it is, and the extreme attacks. There's no balance between the two. There's just this strange thing in the middle that no American writer in some time, or perhaps ever, has been in this position. So I have no tradition to draw on. I don't have much imagination about how to act, you know, except to thumb my nose at some of the critics and to shake hands with some of the others, but it really doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a little easier for me in Europe, where some of the same argument breaks out, but where they tend to be in my favor because they don't feel as directly menaced by the language. So that perhaps the most passionate defense of the novel was from Salman Rushdie, who's not only not American but English, but not entirely English, you see, but also has that other exotic background. And I don't know. I've just been to Minneapolis, and this book, I mean the paperback, just got to the bookstores, and there is a concerned and interested body of readers for it, but they're not easily identifiable. They're not necessarily Village Voice readers or people who go to this kind of bookstore. You know, it's not an ethnic novel quite, and it's not an adventure novel quite, and it may be avant-garde, but it's not like the old familiar avant-garde. So it just has its own group, its own readers.
I hate to oversimplify the story, although I would probably do it anyway, but essentially it's the story of a young man named Wiley, and as he sees the world and growing up, and he sees his adoptive parents and his sister, and in that respect, a lot of it echoes your own life, and it's very difficult to know where Wiley stops and Harold Brodkey takes over. It looks like you've intermersed your entire life with Wiley's, with perhaps exaggerations.
Well, it's difficult for me too. The years ago, when I didn't have much religious education, I had almost no religious education, but at one point, my adoptive parents were what are called assimilated Jews, and at one point, they thought I ought to talk to some really serious rabbis. They're the ones with beards and funny hats and things like that. And so I was driven downtown to that particular neighborhood where they were more or less congregated. And I didn't speak Hebrew, but they did talk to me seriously, and one of the things they pointed out is that the Talmud forbids a Jew to write fiction or journalism. And the reason is that you're not supposed to deal in scandal, and you're not supposed to cause discomfort to other people. And editorial indignation is out of the question because you're supposed to practice forgiveness, but the main thing is you're not to bear false witness. And I guess these conversations, which didn't always please me when I was a child, affected me. And in setting out to write a novel, one of the things that bothered me is not the element of fantasy in the novel, but how I could control it so that I could be reasonably sure, or at least half sure, that I wasn't falsifying things, that I wasn't a force, you know, for dishonesty and untruth. So since I didn't have my own parents, and I'm not sure that I can really imagine it justly or rightly, I thought I'd better make the hero adopted. And since I know about childhood in St. Louis in a certain period, I better not get too far from that, you see? So I drew up this list of things for which I could vouch when I read it over, that this is likely not to be bearing false witness. This is probably, you know, something of truth. There are certain complexities that, because the book is so long, and I think because most readers, again, who like it have an autobiographical experience, and readers who don't like it don't have any experience at all. The structure of the book is a little obscure still in literary circles, but it's a somewhat complicated way of telling a story about a family, but the central character is actually Noni. But the only way that Wiley has for checking himself as the witness is to describe in part his own experiences. That is, at one point he thinks that Noni had an incredibly close tie to an aunt of hers. Well, Wiley's not a girl, and he never had a close tie to an aunt, so he describes instead something that went on between him and a cousin. And more or less, he doesn't exactly extrapolate, but he sets this up as a way of, if not imagining, partly sharing something that his sister went through. That is, if you're a younger child, the story of your life, you know, as a child, is likely to be overshadowed by an older sibling who was always much more vivid to you in a way than you were to yourself. I mean, they were so much more grown up. Did you have an older brother?
I was the oldest in my family.
Oh, you were lucky. Mm. Yeah, but if you're the younger one...
I don't know. When my brother got to stay up till 10 o'clock, he was 8 years old, but I had to go to bed at 10 o'clock by the time I was like 12 or something. And so it was unfair. They were easier on my baby brother.
Well, I think that's true. I think my parents were easier on me than on... I have an older sister. But there was always a sense of this other person who could do these fantastic things. You know, this... I mean, I had childhood, but she had the real life. So I didn't want to use her, and I didn't want to use me, but I wanted a situation where you... instead of using her as a symbol, you know, I mean, to try to create a much more living sense of an actual American life. But how do you know another person's life? And especially if you know, cross genders. When Flaubert wrote Madame Bovary, which is, you know, not a bad book, he said, Madame Bovary, you know, it's me. Well, but I don't think anybody can do that now. I mean, I've been saying this for a couple of years, and it even became sort of a bit of a scandal among writers, and they would suddenly write essays saying, well, of course I can, you know, write from a woman's point of view, or one saying, of course I can write from a man's point of view. Well, of course you can, but how true is it? I mean, how much do you really know? And then, you know, there are other problems as well, which is that...
But doesn't that if one writes from the point of view of another person, as Flaubert said, Madame Bovary was himself, can't you put yourself, can't the writer put him or herself in those other characters? Some writers tell me that if they have a cast of 9 characters in the book, the writer is all of them.
Well, but let me ask you a question. I mean, do you really think they can?
Yeah.
How? What information do they have? How do they know whether they're talking, you know, nonsense or not?
Nobody does. Nobody knows if they're talking nonsense.
Well, that's not true. You know a great deal about your own experience.
Well, yeah, but... Let me throw this out. Say you have a story where you have a villain who is completely unlike you in some respects, in terms of appearance or dress or background. You can still write about that person, and many of the dark elements in your own life could still go into that villain, even though he doesn't resemble you.
Yeah, but the degree of misrepresentation that might be might be so great as to make the whole book either dangerously weak or just dangerously untrue. I mean, I'd do something like that. I mean, Noni is presented as a villain in Wiley's life. And he has to admit that there's no way he could escape her influence. No matter how much he'd like to deny it, whatever he says about her has to be partly true of him. I mean, they grew up with the same parents, and besides which, Noni had a tremendous effect on him when he was growing up. So I had this double thing that I wanted to dramatize, which is, you can't be the villain, although other writers, you know, have said so, and I think they're wrong. And at the same time, you can't escape a complicity and even a close relationship to the villain and the villainy. So it becomes a certain kind of moral examination, as well as a certain kind of story. I don't know if this makes sense to you, but most women, maybe most is too strong, but let's say... For its sake, most women marry men who are engaged to some extent in illicit or violent activities. that if the woman was, well, you know, the women don't actually approve of or like or feel sympathetic toward. How much of it do they actually understand? I mean, I noticed when I was a child growing up that when men wanted to talk about the real world, you know, about payoffs or about the Ku Klux Klan or about boxing or preventing theft, you know, in the junkyard or whatever, they went into another room. There was a, you know, more than a fig leaf. There was a curtain between the world of women and children and the much more violent and not entirely violent, but a more violent and troubled and difficult world of men, at least difficult in this one sense. A boy knows, I think, by the time he's 7 or 8, that if he hangs out with girls or women, there are going to be fewer fistfights, doesn't he? Isn't he safer?
Well, I saw the other day, you're speaking in a very traditional way. I'm not as sure that that is the case as much today as it might have been before, where men did have vastly more vivid lives. Women are much more part of the mainstream in doing more today.
That's a prejudice. I didn't say vivid. I just said more violent.
Well, I prefer to use the word vivid. You say violent. I don't like the term violent because it implies violence. And I think vivid is a better term because men, in the past at least, and perhaps even today, have more vivid lives. I mean, they just do more things.
Well, I
more
saw
interesting.
Two boys, you know, the leaves are down now in the countryside, and I saw these two brothers, you know, very white blonde hair, about 8 and 6, I guess, throwing each other, I mean, you know, wrestling, jumping on each other, throwing the leaves up in the air. They were being pretty violent. But look, the mafia is still not feminine.
That's true.
You know, the army is still not run by women. I had a job once on a loading dock, you know, when the Teamsters were at the height of their power, and it was a great experience, but it was rough. As I say, a boy knows by the time he's 7, he can take shelter, you know, back at home or in certain kinds of suburbs or certain places where, you know, this woman's force is very strong. But there's this other world of men, which is full of conflict and various kinds of combat and competition. And I don't know that, I don't know how much of that women actually understand. I don't know how much men, or any men, can actually understand what goes on with a woman. I was thinking the other day, there's a woman I know who's a minister, and my wife and the minister's husband and some others, and we were talking about, well, not this exactly, but about men and women. And the thing about being pregnant, and this is not putting myself in a woman's place, this is by deduction, is you're invaded by another life. I mean, you share everything in you, you know, blood, tissue, everything, with another life. Well, of course, men don't do that. And the only reason I ever thought about it in the first place was because over the years I've noticed that women don't share the same way men do. They don't cooperate in the same way. And most very attractive women have a certain wall against cooperation with powerful men. It doesn't mean that they don't have, you know, relationships and tight relationships, but they're very troubled. And those very same women can turn around and indulge their children in a certain way, or their sisters, or sometimes women they hardly know, but women who are in trouble. And it just occurred to me that there's a kind of sharing, you know, that you and I don't know, but that if there was a woman sitting here, you know, that she knows, and that this isn't something that can ever be gotten over or passed. I think sometimes that some of the, I use a melodramatic term, some of the rage between men and women is because they both know and sense that the other has virtues and qualities that they can't quite get to, but that they could if they were the same sex.
I'd like to pursue this with you, Harold, but we could talk all afternoon and into the morning. I'm sure we could. But we really are out of time, and I just like to wrap things up by saying now that The Runaway Soul is out in a paperback version, trade paperback version, is going to reach a lot more people because paperbacks are much more accessible than hardcover in many respects. People are more comfortable with them. They don't cost as much. But now the hoopla is died down, the dust has settled, and the book is out. What is in the future for Harold Brodkey?
I don't get to answer this, do I?
You sure do.
What's in the
if
future?
You don't take too much time.
Well, I'm going to bring out a short book. The City of Venice commissioned a book about Venice, and they asked for a novel, and I wrote a short novel about 300 pages, and I'm going to bring that out in the spring. And
will we see it here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's coming out in Italy first, and around Christmas time. And we'll see if it's a simpler structure, and some of the innovations and techniques are I mean, I tried to make it less of what it is. Oh, I don't even know how to put it into words. It's closer to being a traditional book. In fact, for stretches of time, it is a conventional book. We'll see what happens. As far as what's ahead of me in the future, I'm writing a column for the New York Observer, and I'm writing a column for the New Yorker, and I'm nothing that exists. The first time I talked to you, my life was really, it struck me then as being complicated, but it was nothing like the way it is now. But I'm no longer someone is entirely devoted to a single task. So we'll see.
Well, The Runaway Soul, it certainly is a monumental novel by Harold Brodkey. Thank you very, very much, Harold.
That was a strange interview. That's not going to sell any copies.
Don't leave that up to me. I'll take care of it.
You know, when you go out to dinner with another couple, you know, two men and two women, I'm very much aware.